What's going to happen if we put them on the schedule and they renege, might be a good chance that they won't be hurt. Wait till next year. I mean, if you're serious about these things, which I guess you are if you're the author, you should, if you have a time slot, you better take it. So with that, we have the Ortman criminal records. And Bill, I think this committee, Senator Ortman, is looking at Section 1 and 5, I believe, is really what pertains to the Business and Jobs Committee. So welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. President. This is the first time I've been before this committee, so it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for your service on these issues.
Look at these wonderful members, aren't they? Look at them. They're the best. All right, now you can start.
Mr. President, if I could just generally explain what the expungement bill does, and then if we could address the areas that fall clearly within the jurisdiction of this committee. Members, Minnesota has a process now for the expungement or the sealing of criminal records. The way that it can be done currently is under statutory authority. There are three specific areas where we authorize those expungements or the sealing of someone's criminal records. And then there's such a thing as inherent authority. The court on its own can decide after a motion has been brought to it that it will seal the records of someone with a criminal record. There's been some difficulty with that area of the inherent authority to seal records. The courts may be issuing expungements, but the agencies that have been asked to follow the order of the court have not followed the orders of the court. So we need some clarity on the issue of when do we seal criminal records and what happens if the court does grant an order saying that we're going to seal records. So we absolutely need clarity. There's a case currently pending in the Court of Appeals that may or may not resolve some of these issues, but it does not deal with all of the issues. So I would just like for the committee to recognize current law, Chapter 364, we have a section in the law, chapter devoted to the rehabilitation of criminal offenders. And we adopted a policy in 1974, members, that the legislature declares its policy of the state of Minnesota to encourage and contribute to the rehabilitation of criminal offenders and to assist them in the resumption of the responsibilities of citizenship. The opportunity to secure employment or to pursue practice or engage in a meaningful and profitable trade, occupation, vocation, profession, or business is essential to rehabilitation and the resumption of the responsibilities of citizenship. Members, I bring this to your attention because one of the crises we are facing now or we are about to face is the fact that we have so many people with criminal records, and those records are so much more prevalent now because of databases and technological changes that people are finding it very difficult to secure employment, and employers have to deal with the fact that they can't find people that they can employ, or if they want to employ someone with a criminal background, they face liability for negligent hiring because there was a criminal record that they knew or should have known about. So the sections of this bill that are before this committee now are about those employment applications and the employment relationships. Under this bill, we are not sealing any criminal records. Let me just say that again. This bill will not seal one record. What it does is gives the court a process by which it may determine that we should be sealing criminal records. And there's a significant process in the other portions of the bill that have been through the Judiciary Committee and passed through that committee. The sections in this committee are about two things. One, it should our employment applications clarify whether someone has to identify a record that's been expunged. If the court has ordered an expungement, I believe, and this bill would clarify that an applicant for a job who has an expungement order for the court does not have to say that he or she has been convicted of a crime, because the court has ordered that he or she does not have to acknowledge that crime. And then secondly, in the bill, it would protect our employers to allow them to rely on the court. If the court says, employer, you do not need to discover what's beneath an expunged record. You can rely on the records in the BCA. If it's been expunged, you don't have to worry about it, and this person is safe for employment. That's so that those employers do not face negligent hiring lawsuits if they hire someone with a criminal conviction that has been subsequently expunged by the court. In essence, the court then takes the responsibility if that the employer does not need to know what's in this person's background before the expungement. So that's before this committee, and I hope this committee will support this bill. I have some handouts for the committee, if we could. There's an interesting article from the Detroit Free Press from February of 2007 that talks about in Michigan 1.8 million people with criminal records, 1.3 million of them are felonies. If we don't help people get jobs, we're going to have a very serious crisis with folks on unemployment, and when those unemployment benefits cease, then what happens to them? They're likely to revert back to crime or drugs. And then I've gotten a couple of very interesting emails that I'll share with the committee from people in Minnesota who would be affected by this, who have lost hope by the fact that they've spent 20 or 30 years and have not been able to find productive employment. And so I think they're very compelling. We also heard very compelling testimony in the Judiciary Committee from ex-offenders who have struggled for 20 and 30 years, not able to obtain employment in the state of Minnesota, not able to support their families, not able to support themselves. And so we are facing a pending crisis, if we don't have it now, that these folks do not have constructive opportunity to regain citizenship.
Any questions of the author? Are there a couple of people I wish to speak? Senator Ortman, I have Phil Carruthers and Rick Neumeister.
Hello.
I welcome Mr. Carruthers, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, and members. I'm Philip C. Carruthers. I'm the director of the Prosecution Division for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And the County Attorney's Office does oppose this bill. We're not against the idea of rehabilitating offenders and giving them a second chance. And we have proposed a number of ways to do that. We participated in what was called a delivery team. It was essentially a working group of CrimNet to come up with some ways to deal with expungement. But our approach to expungement is that it should be much more limited than would be provided in this bill. This bill is an extremely broad bill. And our view is that if you had a lower-level offender changed his or her life and gone through drug treatment or just been law-abiding for a substantial number of years, shown rehabilitation, then we have no problem with the idea of giving the person a second chance. But this, as I say, goes way beyond that because there's basically no limit on what type of offense could be sealed, could be expunged under this bill. Even the most serious offenses could be expunged. We're talking about murders. We're talking about serious financial crimes such as swindling a small business owner out of tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're talking about domestic assaults. We're talking about serious driving conduct such as DWIs or even criminal vehicular operation or homicide could be sealed under this bill. And to just give courts that kind of green light to seal convictions is not wise. The reason that 609A, which is the current law on expungement, was passed was because judges were doing it without notice to prosecutors, without notice to law enforcement agencies. This would still require that. But they were very liberal, frankly, in granting expungements. And we don't want to go back to that day where judges were just very liberal in granting expungements. So that's the basis of our concern. Going to the employment issues that this committee deals with, this bill would essentially prohibit anybody except law enforcement from having access to that sealed record. So, for example, if you were a securities company, a finance company, and you wanted to hire a securities agent, a broker, if it was sealed, even a swindling conviction, if it were sealed, you couldn't get access to it. Most licensing boards are excluded from this bill. In other words, they would not have access. So the Commerce Department, for example, that regulates realtors and financial professionals and all sorts of occupations, they would not have access to it once a court decided to seal it. Even the medical board would not have access to it for purposes of doctors, or the lawyers board for purposes of lawyers. So you could have a lawyer who has perhaps before that person went to law school, has a swindling conviction, a serious felony swindling conviction, and the lawyers board could not find out about that conviction. And so employers, small businesses, employers that deal with people's money and have a lot of responsibility, they would not have access to even the most serious offenses. And it's not wise public policy. We're exposing citizens to risk of people with serious criminal convictions being hired and then having access to their money and otherwise making important decisions about them. And there's not even a limit on how many offenses could be expunged. In our county, we see people with several felony theft convictions that are being expunged. Not just one, but several felony theft convictions are being expunged. Do you really want that kind of person working as a banker? Or at least not giving that bank who's hiring that person the opportunity to make the decision as to whether to hire that person, knowing what their criminal history is. So that's our concern, Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator,
if I could just respond, I think it's unfortunate that Mr. Carruthers wants to rehash the conversation in the Judiciary Committee. This is a very serious issue, and so I appreciate him coming forward with these concerns. But let me just say that his last argument was a good case for this bill. The judges currently are granting expungements with no consideration to factors that we would want them to consider. This bill sets out factors that they must consider before granting an expungement, including the severity of the crime. There must be notice and opportunity for a victim to be heard. It's a public hearing. The media will be welcome to attend and to oppose and to report on everything that occurs in the court. But this bill is about trusting our judges to use their discretion to determine if someone has been rehabilitated. And so I would encourage you to look at the language in the bill that now would require those judges to go through a process, notify the public and the prosecutor. It will be the prosecutor's opportunity and responsibility to oppose an expungement under any circumstances, and they will be given time to do that. And then there's a waiting period and process for appeal. So there are adequate protections here for members of the public. Let me also just say that we should be trusting our courts with this discretion. They are the ones that will be able to see someone on a case-by-case basis and evaluate whether or not they have been rehabilitated and whether or not they should be given a fresh start. And so I appreciate the fact that the prosecutors oppose this, but I think that the judges are capable of handling this discretion, and we want to make sure that we allow them the opportunity to do that. But we want to do it with the factors that we expect them to consider, like the length of time since the crime, or what their employment has been since the conviction, what the victims might say. We want them to have our process when they do that work.
Any questions of Senator Salstrom?
On that point, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, your comment is that our businesses can't find people to work. There's nothing in statute now that wouldn't prevent businesses from hiring some of these people. So I guess it's like we're taking away an employer's chance to be able to really look at someone's record. And I guess if I was an employer, I would want to have that information because I still may hire them, but at least I'm aware of the background. I will tell you that on this particular bill, I received more sort of email from my constituents. I was like, what is this bill? You know, I saw it coming up, but people felt very strongly about it. In Washington County, and this was just an email from a constituent, that a sex offender whose record was expunged was hired at a South Washington County school and then molested two girls. There was another situation of where an FBI terrorism task force was not allowed to go into a man's sealed records to view his credit card fraud records, but once they went through all the loopholes, found the information too late, and this particular individual had already left the state. So I'm very concerned, and I'm listening to the other testifier here today, is that has this bill gone too far? Because we certainly want to give people hope. But we also have to, I think, protect the rights of employers and the people that they serve to be able to hire people, but at least have some sense of what might be some issues I need to watch for. Do I want to give this person a chance and see how they do? But if I don't have that information, I can't do that.
Senator Boardman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. I appreciate your comments. I think one of the reasons why we're getting an awful lot of comments about this, and I'm getting them too, on both sides. Mm-hmm. There was some confusion about my bill and Senator Moi's bill, Senate File 279, which had an automatic expungement provision so that bills criminal records would automatically be sealed after a certain length of time. This bill does not do that. It sealed records. My bill does not seal one record. What it does is creates the process for the courts to determine when we should be expunging the records. And the two cases that you talked about would not occur. This bill wouldn't affect, would actually protect against what happened. First of all, sex offenses, where they're registered, they are accepted here. So no registered sex offender bill or record will ever be sealed. And then secondly, law enforcement has complete access for purposes of investigation, for employment, for anything else. There's no limit whatsoever in this bill for the use of criminal records by the criminal justice agencies. And again, I would remind the committee that those issues were dealt with. We made significant amendments to this bill to respond to the county attorney's concerns in the Judiciary Committee. Now we're talking about employment issues. And I think that the reason I think the employment, I think if you've got an expungement record or a sealed record, it should mean something when you apply for a job. And if the court has determined, now it's gone through the process, it's notified the victim, the prosecutors have opposed it if they've wanted to, it's been subject to appeal. Now if there is an order, it should mean something. And right now, the expungement orders from the court don't mean a whole lot if the private data harvesters have them, if the BCA is reporting them to the public, if they're all over the media, it doesn't mean a whole lot. And so if you have it, it should mean something. And the employers should not be punished for not checking back through the expungement process. That's what's happening now. You've got employers like a Dairy Queen, for instance, or a big franchise where they've got applicants for jobs, say, for assistant manager, and there are cases in the law about this now, where you could apply for that job. They might want to give you the job, but because you've got a conviction, you might have passed the probationary period. But their corporate policy is, no, I'm sorry, you can't work here because you have a conviction. You might be a good employee. It might have been 10 years before that you had your conviction. But now because of their fear out of negligent hiring lawsuits, they're going to turn you down despite your work product, despite the fact that you've been rehabilitated, and we need to consider that. That's what the purpose of this section is, Senator.
Senator Scheid.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Are we focusing on sections 1 and 5?
Yes.
Just those two, am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And I think that that's important, and I wanted to say something to former Speaker Carruthers because he – I was his senator once.
still is,
actually. I think he still has his house there. But
lucky guy. Huh?
Yes. And that is that I know you have some I understand the overall concern. I happen to think that it's important to achieve what Senator Ortman is trying to do here and what we talked about at great length, I think, over the course of two hearings in the Judiciary Committee. And I think there are still some things to be done to tighten it up. For example, maybe on DWIs, that sort of thing, people with those kinds of issues in their past. I think that that probably is better, and I think the chair agrees, those are probably better dealt with. I think this is going to one of Senator Foley, or to Senator Foley's committee at some point. And so even though I share some of those concerns, focusing on Sections 1 and 5, I think the good thing here is that it removes the liability from the employer if they should hire somebody and be willing to give them a second chance. I think right now they're just playing it safe and not hiring people with any kind of a record at whatsoever. And it could be, well, if you've, I don't know if you've seen the one from the fellow from in the Detroit Free Press is interesting. We had that in the Judiciary Committee. But you can imagine spending 20 or 30 years trying to fight back something you did when maybe, when you were 18 years old or 21 years old, and now you're 50 and you're still hounded by that record, even though you've, been totally straight all these years. The frustration that has to be for people is strong. And so I think this is a really solid attempt, and I think it's been worked through. It's not complete yet, but in terms of what we have to look at in terms of jobs and employment, it says that I think the statement would have to be whether or not that the information does not apply to sealed or expunged criminal records, and then it has the release of liability in Section 5 for that employer who hasn't looked at those records. And I don't think that the Section 1 is too burdensome. I think it's pretty straightforward. And it certainly would help people who have a record. I mean, I've heard all sorts of advice from people about just answer no or leave it blank. Leave it blank, and then if you get an interview with an employer and you have something on your a criminal record, then try to explain it. It isn't working, apparently, for people to do that route either. There may be a person here or there that gets a job, but I think by and large employers are playing it safe. And I can't say I blame them, but this would be helpful to them. I think it's important that we focus on Sections 1 and 5.
Mr. Carruthers, did you have a...
Just briefly, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your comments, Senator Scheid. There were changes to the bill in Judiciary, and essentially, first of all, it does take out most sex offenses. Second of all, it takes care of a lot of the concerns that law enforcement had and prosecutors had as to their own records, because those will still be available to law enforcement, to prosecutors. Yeah. But what's really left out is employers and licensing agencies. Almost no licensing agency would have access to these sealed records. And so, somebody that maybe got a sealed record before they decided to apply to be a stockbroker, the Commerce Department wouldn't know anything about it. It might be a very serious swindling offense. And the question is, do you want that person to get a license? Or an employer who's running a child care agency, before the person ever applied or was even thinking about wanting to be a child care worker, that person had an excessive punishment conviction or a crime against a child. It might be a domestic abuse charge. Conviction. I'm talking convictions here. I'm not talking about arrests. That would then be sealed to that child care agency. And yes, perhaps they would be protected from liability, but what about the child? There's nothing in this bill that protects the child. There's nothing in this bill that protects the customer of that stockbroker who didn't know that his stockbroker had a swindling conviction. That's the problem.
Senator Ortman, then we're going to move on.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, the chapter that I was talking about, criminal offenders and rehabilitation, makes it current law that criminal records shall not be used, distributed, or disseminated by the state of Minnesota, its agents or agencies or political subdivisions for purposes of employment if the convictions have been expunged. And that's what our courts are ordering them to do. They're making this determination and saying, these records do not need to be reviewed when you make subsequent employment decisions. And I think we can trust the judges. They go through vigorous training. They've been experienced in our communities. Our communities know them and trust them to make these decisions. It's a weighty decision, to be sure. But the victims, the media, and the prosecutors will be there to protect us and to register their concerns about it on a case-by-case basis, which is far better than just having a set rule that doesn't make sense when those people come to the court to talk about their rehabilitation.
Mr. Neumeister, did you wish to address the august body?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to appear before you. And for all those folks that are new, my name is Rich Neumeister, and I've been here a very long time. lobbying on issues of privacy, civil liberties, and openness in government issues. First of all, I gave you a handout. I don't know if you have it or not. This is an example of what a number of employers do. And if you see the little area marked on there, it will show you basically what Section 1 is asking. And this is from Krispy Kreme. I didn't get official permission. I just went and was looking around for some applications, and several of them are this as an example. Secondly, this is not something that came about in the night with nobody ever knowing about any of those kinds of things. As Representative Carruthers indicated to you, there was a major, almost a year and a half, thousands of dollars studied where I participated in almost nearly 50 hours of meetings, Representative Speaker Carruthers did, and a number of other people. All this is online, and it's called Report of the Background Checks and Expungement Delivery Team. So when this gets to the floor, you might want to browse yourself on that. Secondly, in 1967, it was President Johnson's commission about law enforcement. And one of the things he said then, that report, was that someone with an arrest record or with a conviction record, just one, or an arrest or conviction, they're marked. People are more apt to deny them employment and other kinds of things at that time. Well, 40 years later, we're still talking about the same thing in another research done. Scarlet Letters and Recidivism: does an old criminal record predict future offending? But one of the things that happens is that the issue that I stated to you, which the Crime Commission Task Force appointed by President Johnson indicated, is the same thing is happening, that mark becomes sort of like a scarlet letter. Now, is this law in Section 1, I don't know about Section 5, but Section 1 completely new to the state of Minnesota? No. A number of fair states have those, and I'll just read off some of them. California, Illinois, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, and I'll give you an example from Texas, which just passed in 2003, I believe. Now, each state has a different kind of expungement of records. Some will do convictions and arrests. Some will do less serious, more serious. So it's all over, scattered on a board. But this is what Texas says. A person whose criminal history record information has been sealed under this section, in their expungement section, it is not required in any application for employment, information, or licensing to state that the person has been the subject of any criminal proceeding related to the information that is the subject of an order issued under this section, in other words, of non-disclosure. That's what they call that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are other state statutes that I can quote that have very similar kinds of language, so this is not new. I can say at least you're going on some experience ground with what other states have done. Secondly, you've had, and I knew both of them, Ken Nelson and Alan Speer, in Chapter 364. Now, in terms of licensing agencies, there's probably about 90 to 92% are not excluded from the Offender Rehabilitation Act, but some are. So, you know, and until 2004, until what is known as the Schultz decision, the courts did a lot of expungements, and they were recognized a lot by law enforcement entities and the BCA until that became part of a topic of discussion. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much. And just on the last point about something I was involved in with. For 17 years, I worked for the Wilder Foundation as an emergency crisis counselor on weekends. And one of the things that that program does, almost any program licensed by the state of Minnesota that works with children, has rigorous due process and rigorous evaluation about their backgrounds. Who has access to expunged records? And for those people that are on Health and Human Services, you know that as 245C, I think it is, which does a lot of background checks, and they do hundreds of thousands of them per year. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's my point in speaking to Section 1 of the bill. Any questions?
Any questions? Any further comments by the senators or anybody else wish to be heard? This bill would – oh, there's a – somebody raising their hand.
There's several, Mr.
Hey, where'd they all come from? Can you kind of, are you all, you in agreement on what you're going to be talking about, you four or five, or no, or you don't know? I thought three or four could sit at the front desk at the same
time.
I'm
not sure they all know each other, Mr.
Do they? All right, come on.
I guess I can start, Mr. Chair, if that's...
We're going to stick to the sections I talked about, okay? The employment, sections 1 and 5. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Melinda Hugdahl. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. We represent low-income Minnesotans across the state, and we are here in support of Senate File 294, Senator Ortman's bill. This bill provides meaningful relief for our clients and significantly improves their ability to find employment and become or remain productive members of society. Under current law, our clients in many cases are encouraged to find employment, to work their way from public assistance into a meaningful level of ability to support themselves. However, they find that when they have a criminal conviction or a criminal record, they're unable to get employment. And so they're caught in this cycle they can't escape from. They want to get off of assistance, or they're not eligible anymore for assistance, but they're unable to find employment. A significant barrier for our clients is the past criminal offense, many of which for our clients are crimes of poverty. And I just very briefly want to give you two examples where we have had cases that under current law have left our clients in this kind of legal limbo of the ability of them to really get meaningful relief. We had a client that had a 1992 theft conviction. She wrote two bad checks from her own account during a family crisis. She had no other record. She pled guilty to the offense. Since then, she'd done significant rehabilitation. She had no other criminal record, and she came before the court to ask to have the record sealed. She'd been trying to find employment and could not. The judge found that she was worthy of expungement, having the record sealed. There was no issue, but because of the case law from 2004 and his ability to only seal the judicial records, he felt it wouldn't do her any good because the BCA records were all still public. So he denied that petition. She remains unemployed and is ineligible for public assistance. So she is not working and is still trying to find a job. I have another example of a 1996, 11 years ago, misdemeanor conviction, no other record. She had regular participation in the workforce center, worked with a job counselor, volunteered with her kids' activities. She could not find a job. The judge, when she asked the court to have her record sealed, sealed the records, but only sealed the judicial records. The BCA records remain open. We've kept in touch with that client. She's been forced to rely on MFIP. She's moved in with her children, with her mother, because she cannot support herself. These are the clients that we have. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about the serious offenses, and we don't want to have people with sex offenses or other serious crimes having those sealed either. But we would ask that you really keep in your mind those people with low-level offenses who are really trying to find employment. To get them. Senator Ortman's bill has significant standards in the bill for what you have to establish. If you are seeking a license, you have to establish to the court what kind of license you're seeking and how your offense relates to it. And so we're supportive of Senator Ortman's bill. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dan Kane. I am the president of a nonprofit organization called RS Eden. We have several drug abuse treatment programs, correctional halfway houses, supportive housing, electronic monitoring, drug testing, and we have roughly about 1,200 people that we provide services to on any given day. Personally, I chaired the Sentencing Commission from 1986 until 1991. I also chaired the group that lobbied for licensure of alcohol and drug counselors and chaired the group that wrote the licensing laws for alcohol and drug counselors, and I'm also an ex-offender. When I got out of prison in 1972, there were 1,200 inmates in the state of Minnesota. In 1982, when I was appointed by Governor Cui to the Sentencing Commission, there were 1,800 inmates. Today, we're approaching 9,000 inmates. In 1972, there were approximately 1,000 people released from prison each year. Today, there are 7,000. We have collectively as a group, this group has put in place collateral consequences, limiting access to many careers over that time. And as a society, we have developed to the point where virtually any minimum wage employer or slumlord can do background checks, which can find out very quickly criminal information. Representative, our county attorney and former Representative Carruthers talked about the danger to people not having this information. I would argue conversely, the danger to having 7,000 people each year released into a community where resources are less than they were in 1980 in terms of supervision, in terms of support, in terms of halfway houses, where we've come to rely on electronic gadgets to do what probation officers used to do, and send them out there without the ability to get jobs, without the ability to find housing, and in fact, not being afraid of prison because they've already been there. Now, there is there are a number of states that have begun to try and pass remedies to the criminal history prohibition, the collateral consequences that people experience long after their crimes have been put to rest. Connecticut, for one, has created something called a certificate of rehabilitation. They've gone so far as to tie that certificate of rehabilitation into their civil rights legislation, making it a crime for people to not hire people who have been given this certificate of rehabilitation. What Senator Ortman's bill does, and it doesn't create the certificate of rehabilitation, but it does talk about a process for expungement. It says that you have to meet certain criteria, including proof of rehabilitation, before you're even eligible. But once you've done that, it doesn't necessarily guarantee you expungement. It still leaves it to the court. I would argue that that is a reasonable way to go, and that we have to find some way to give people, we have to provide a means for people to achieve redemption once they've reached a certain point where they are no longer burdened by the actions of the past. Two examples that come to mind for me where this has created a great problem just for individuals today. One of our Fortune 500 companies from Minnesota, very respected, well-loved company, employs lots of people, had a gentleman working in their mailroom as part of a temporary jobs contract that they had with someone who provided basically day labor and temporary jobs. Worked in the mailroom for 2 years as this temporary jobs function. A full-time job in the mailroom came open. His supervisors, his coworkers, everyone else recommended that he apply for the full-time job. He did a great job. He was well-loved and appreciated by the people around him, applied for the full-time job, got it, and was offered the job, at which point he accepted, and they instituted a background check. 15 years earlier, he had a theft crime. This particular company had a provision in their policies that said they would not hire anyone with a felony conviction. So consequently, the job offer was withdrawn. He did not get the job. Furthermore, the temporary company that had employed him for 2 years and this particular job where he'd done a good job was told that they could no longer employ him if they wanted to continue to provide the service to this company. Another example within my own agency, I had a woman who worked for me for 7 years and then decided to go to Georgia. The previous gentleman talked about Chapter 245C, the background check provision for programs that are licensed by the Department of Human Services and Department of Health. She came back from Georgia this year and applied for a job. During that time, the laws had changed. We had modified Chapter 245C, wherein in the past we allowed the Commissioner of Human Services to grant set-asides, if you will, for people who had been shown to be rehabilitated. We took that away for certain crimes. This woman committed a prostitution crime in Chicago in 1980. Unfortunately, prostitution, 609.322, or solicitation of prostitution, disqualifies you from ever working in a program that has a Department of Human Services or Department of Health license. Now, she was not convicted of 609-322. 609-322 relates to solicitation, and it relates to prostitution with children. However, she was arrested in Chicago. In Chicago, she was arrested for common prostitution, standing on a street corner for $20. But because there was not a mechanism to map their crime to our crime, the word solicitation in their crime, the word solicitation in our crime, they map to each other. So she's being held accountable for a felony behavior 27 years later that wasn't a felony and resulted in a $35 fine in Chicago. She's unable to receive, to take this job. We're unable to employ her. Reentry is fast becoming the buzzword, not because we want to be nice to criminals, but because if we don't, we do so at our own peril. The degree to which we keep people from getting jobs and places to live, especially when they no longer have the intuitive fear of prison that you and I have, it can only result in one thing. You limit their choices, they will choose what they know. Now, I'm not speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Corrections Association today, but I want to make that, and I want to make that clear. But let me tell you that I have in front of me, and I'll pass it around, I only have one copy, a position paper from the Minnesota Corrections Association for 2007 legislation. And I quote in part, recommended strategy items, create a certificate of rehabilitation and a process for obtaining it, and then make those who hold it a protected class under civil rights legislation.
Yeah, we've only got three, four more bills up, but we've got about an hour and a half.
We'll pass this out, and perhaps the page can pass it on. Thank you.
There's another stop to this bill, so at least one more step, probably two steps.
Okay. Sir, madam, my name is Richard Amos. I was released from Stillwater Prison in 1992. I was a mad kid. I was mad from the time, ever since I could remember. It looked like white people had everything and we had nothing. You know, we would run out of food in the middle of a month and have to scrap for food. And me and my brother and little sister would go in grocery stores and eat our way out. As an adult, I became a drug addict, went to Stillwater Prison. And when I got out, after sleeping about a week on a couch, Child Protection called me and said, "We caught your daughter in a drug raid." She was 11. She knew how to bag it and sell it. When I got out, my best friend who robbed banks said, "Hey, come stay with me," because he was living pretty nice at that time. But I knew the police would be there sooner or later. And I didn't want to stay with him and go back to that life. I wanted to live a decent life. And I told my daughter we were going to live a decent life. She said, "Will there be rules?" I said, "Definitely." She said, "I don't know if I'm going to like that." But anyways, I began the application process of putting in for jobs. And my criminal history would always come up. And I had a dedicated criminal history. I didn't have a little criminal history. I had like a phone book of stuff. So I didn't blame them for really turning me down, but it kind of locked me into a subculture. Either I could go back to selling drugs or go back to robbing banks or whatever with my best friend, or, you know, do some other crime to make some money to survive. But I wanted a job. And I took the crappiest jobs I could find and didn't mind working, because if it was paying $5 and some cent an hour, at least I was working honestly. In prison, I decided to live my life another way. My daughter used to skip school, and I'll make this short, not a long story, but she used to skip school, and I found out she had missed about 13 days out of the month. And I asked her why she skipped school, and she said, "Well, they teach you the same thing every day." And I said, "Well, you need to know this stuff so that when you go to college, it'll be easy for you." She said, "Did you go to college?" And I said, "No, but I'm going to register today." And so I went in, I registered, and it was a struggle through college, but I knew she was watching me, and I thank God I made it. But looking for jobs after college was a nightmare, and I started working at St. Stephen's as a furniture mover. But a case manager position came open, and I took that, and I worked it as hard as I could. I told landlords they could call me 24 hours a day. But anyways, the program that we developed became a nationally recognized program. I'm the director of the program today. And out of this national directed program, Bill Gates sent his team out here to study our program because it was so effective. Then he sent his researchers back to study it one more time. We're on HUD's website as one of the best practice models. And it kind of came from the old life because I had to read between the lines to see how I could steal something or how I could take advantage of a situation. Today I'm here as a supporter and as a person that has a $1 million budget, and I write checks. I was the worst thief in the neighborhood. I write checks, and I've been writing checks for the past 7 years, and there's nothing going wrong with the program. We have checks, all kind of checks and balances, and I told you, Bill Gates, he don't have funny researchers. He has sharp researchers. But I'm saying whenever we went to apply for an application, there would be a box that said, have you been convicted of a crime? Now I'm working with juveniles and adults to get them in housing, and landlords don't want to rent to them because of the criminal history. So some properties we rent through St. Stephen's, and we monitor and help them make a good transition back into the community. I'm here today to say that there may not be racism like it was way back in the day, but there's an undercurrent of racism in the choices that we make to keep people locked into a box. In the black community, we have what they call gangs. When people come out of prison and can't go back to mainstream society because of these roadblocks, the gang has jobs for them, has good jobs. They get paid pretty good, but they're going to have to do some time every once in a while. But I'm here today to say that you can open that door from that box in a limited way, whichever way will provide safety to the community. I'm for safety. I'm for people not stealing. I'm for people working and making an honest living, but we have to provide those opportunities. If a black person and a white person, both with criminal histories, a study was done in New York, went to apply for the same job, they had the same backgrounds, this white person would be hired, they said, 75% of the time. The black person with the criminal history would be hired about 20% of the time. So through their own stats, they're saying there's racism, and we just want to live business as usual. Me, I don't want to try to mentor or try to educate offenders coming out, trying to change their lives, and them running into the roadblock of not being able to get employment because of that criminal history. It's almost like a joke. I don't want to joke with people. They have families. They have kids. Even many of them are paying child support, and they run from legal jobs because if they started working, they'd have to pay so much in child support. But if they got a decent job, as Dan said and others said sitting here, then that would not only pay for the children's support, but it would show the children that this is a better life to live. My daughter, who is a drug seller, she looks at Dad today and she says, I love you. She calls me 3-4 times a day. She says, I love you for accepting her, not going back to drugs or crime, and being a role model for her to live a decent life. My one prayer in prison was, let my mother live long enough to see me live a decent life, because she never taught me none of this crap. And so whatever you do here today, if you do the positive and let the bill pass, then offenders have a chance. If you don't let the bill pass, then we're just going to have to spend more money building more prisons and keep recycling them in and out. And reentry is a joke. Reentry will be a joke. Because how are you going to reenter society and you can't get a job? You can't maintain your household. So with that, I thank you.
Very good. That's a great success story. But you should have Bill Gates adopt you.
I know. Give us some money. I said give Minnesota some money.
Follow
send
the
Bill
money.
Himself.
All right, I did. Young lady, did you wish to... And then we're going to vote. Then we're going to vote. Don't take as long as your friend did, okay?
Okay, I won't. I won't. Hello, everyone, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Shante Holmes, and I would like to start off by saying I've heard a lot of theys. I'm actually a they that they're talking about, an individual who's experienced some criminal activity, and I would like to share with you why I feel it's very important to allow me the ability to be self-sufficient. I have a son that's autistic, okay? So I do understand about not allowing individuals of various different backgrounds to be able to work with them, but not only them, I cannot even work with my child if asked. I have completed my degree in school, and it was a very, very tough course. Not the education and the curriculum, because I was on the dean's list several times, several semesters. But what was the most challenging aspect of the degree was when I got to the internship. And the internship required me to work for free for an organization that would allow me to be in the human service field. Those organizations might have been PPL, Lutheran Social Services, Anoka Mental Health, Genesis, which I was declined for all of them. This is at the very ending of my degree. I finally found an organization, a nonprofit, thank goodness, that they did not have to go through the barriers and government policies and stuff in order to run a background check, because they allowed me, and their organization was called Amigas, the Latin word for friends, which meant giving back. And I just feel, as an individual who has been rehabilitated and definitely has a vision for individuals who have undergone what I have, in order to help them, why not have someone who's overcame the barriers and the struggles be there to walk side by side with them in order to help them to see that society is willing to give you a chance again. And I just want to say another thing. I'm going to make the assumption that most of you are parents, so I'm sure you'll understand this metaphor. If society was a parent, now we just experienced a blizzard, what, just a couple days ago? Your child misbehaved, society, okay? As this metaphor is a parent. Your child misbehaves. You reprimand him, you punish him, and then you move on. Either your child is allowed to come back at the dinner table and eat again, or do you allow your child or not allow your child to come back once the punishment has been served or she's complied with all of the recommendations that you've needed or necessary for her to be a productive family member again? How do you make that determination? Do you put your child out in the blizzard and say you'll never, ever, ever be able to reenter and be respected as a family member? Or you've paid your dues, you've served what you needed to do, and here as your mother, I am willing to allow you to come back in home. Thank you.
Very good. I think that we're ready to, what committee does it go to?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, what does this do to the workload of the judges?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, Ortman. That issue will be taken up in the courts committee, the subdivision of the courts committee. The courts currently are processing expungement motions, so that won't change. They currently are doing them. Whether there will be more or not is a question that will be taken up in that committee. We haven't had any testimony about that yet. I think that there's a fiscal note being prepared for that, but again, that will be taken up in that courts committee.
Okay. Senator Day, would you like to move the bill and council word it? Who's asked for it? Or?
Finance.
And forwarded to the Finance Committee on the Day motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, members.
Interesting stories. That's success stories. Senator Higgins, you've been sitting there patiently. Senate File 1355. Hennepin Carver Workforce Investment Board. Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Get my act together here. I'm sorry. I believe that a couple of weeks ago, you heard a presentation, and here was the handout. You might have it in your packets again. Do I understand? Okay. Well, this is this presentation you got a couple of weeks ago about the healthcare workforce shortage here in Minnesota. The Hennepin County Human Services and the Hennepin Carver Workforce Investment Board have been doing a lot of work trying to make sure that the crisis that we think is coming is mitigated a little bit in the healthcare occupations, because we know that the trend line isn't looking good. We have today's shortage with our supply of RNs, for example, and here is the demand. And when we get out to like 2007, you can see we've got a long ways to go. I have here Bruce Knott from Hennepin County, and he's an analyst at Hennepin County, and he did the background on this. This bill would give funding for continuing to work on this project. Mr. Knott.
And welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bruce Knott. I work at Hennepin County as a planning analyst. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don't have much to say other than what we said last week, but obviously there's a tremendous demand. There's a problem with supply, and if we don't correct that, we have a severe crisis approaching. We have the opportunity to make that correction and take some action, and it'll be another step towards dealing with health care as a problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, this these programs are really working well. You know, we need to do more of this. Just gets down to the old story again, dollars. So well, we know they work. It's just a matter of good luck at the next stop, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Next stop would be Senator Tomasoni's.
Yeah, I think we technically refer it to the full finance, then they shift it down. So I don't know. Senator Scoy, would you like to make that motion?
I'll move on.
Any further discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Senator Dibble is here. Senator Dibble.
Hey, let's hear some of those Wednesday bills.
Good morning. Good afternoon, I guess.
Good afternoon, yeah. Quite a day, yeah.
34.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1334 would appropriate money for the purpose of retaining minority enterprises, and it relates more specifically to the Midtown Global Market, which is in the redeveloped Sears building on Lake Street in Minneapolis. Which hopefully everyone here has been to. It's a pretty remarkable development after many, many years of varying proposals for that stretch or that particular facility in that stretch along Lake Street. This finally came to pass, and it's a very, very vibrant, very exciting, literally as it's described, global market with the many micro entrepreneurs who have stalls and selling wares of all kinds, food and crafts and all sorts of goods. What this bill would propose to do is appropriate money for a variety of purposes to help make sure that this venture is successful. What needs to happen so that these micro-entrepreneurs are successful, that this whole venture is successful, is pay down some debt, develop some working capital, create a loan fund for some of these small entrepreneurs. They need some money to attract some key businesses that would serve as some anchor tenants to attract the kind of customer base that will make this a long-term success, and then serve use some capital for business incubator purposes. We have a couple of folks here who can better describe the proposal, tell you what's going on with the Midtown Global Market, why it's been a great success, why it's been such a big benefit to the entire community in that area, and what they propose to do.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Also, my name is Mike Tamale. I'm the executive director of the Neighborhood Development Center, which is one of the four nonprofit organizations that developed and owns the Midtown Global Market. This is a public market similar in scale and in feel to a Pike's Place Market or a Reading Terminal Market in Philadelphia Vancouver Islands, or Vancouver's Granville Island public market. It's obviously new. Those are all 50 to 100 years old, so it's going to take a while to get there. But there's a big difference with this public market, and that is that it also serves as a business incubator for, right now, 50 small startup, locally owned businesses. 90% are owned by minorities, persons of color, and recent immigrants. The nonprofits that developed this have been doing this kind of work for about 15 years. We developed previously the Mercado Central at Lake in Bloomington, which has 47 Latino businesses in it. That started 8 years ago, and that has an 80% success rate of small businesses. We train these folks in an extensive entrepreneur training program that goes on for 4 months. Then we have financing available for them. And in some cases like this, we then develop business incubators, and in this case, in the form of a public market. Right now, we have 3,500 customers a day coming to the global market. And our challenge is that, which is actually well ahead of our projections. We had projected 2,500 a day. But the challenge is converting these visitors into serious shoppers. Too many of them, unfortunately, are kind of wanderers, people that love public markets, like my mother and my wife and my kids, but they don't come to do serious grocery shopping, which is our own fault in the sense that we've probably been too heavily branded as a place for a great ethnic meal or music, live music, or maybe some of the arts and crafts you see in that catalog going around. What we feel we need to do in a hurry here is increase the grocery offerings we have, in particular both the ethnic grocery offerings and the Minnesota-grown offerings, as well as increase customer convenience so that grocery shopping can become the driver that brings us above break even. Most of the businesses in there had a good summer, they had a lousy fall, and they've had a good winter, which is a little counterintuitive. But by good, I mean they're approaching break even. This is a ramp up situation. We all anticipated a 6 to 12 to 18 month ramp up period to reach break even. And one of the things we're trying to achieve here is getting as many of these entrepreneurs trained up and successful so they can survive until they get above break even. One of the requests we have is for money that would allow us to reduce the rent there for 4 years, because right now we're over $32 a square foot plus utilities, which is pretty high. This was a very expensive project to do because it was a historic rehab of the largest building in the state of Minnesota other than the Mall of America, the Sears building, and it sat vacant for 10 years. Another thing we're asking for is some dollars to make working capital loans to these entrepreneurs to bridge them through the ramp-up period here. They're all working with business experts to create stronger business plans. And like I said, most of them are doing okay, but they're not quite at break-even, and what we're trying to do is push them over the top here. I think with that, I'll end and ask John Flore from one of our partner organizations, the Latino Economic Development Center, to say a few words.
Good. Welcome.
Thank you.
As Mike said, my name is John Flore. I work for the Latino Economic Development Center. I want a small business development organization for Latino immigrants. I want to talk a little bit more about the incubation process of small businesses and my experience in nearly 20 years of work with small businesses in South Minneapolis and the incredible resource that immigrant entrepreneurs have proved to be in South Minneapolis. 8 years ago, I came over to the Senate with one of my small business clients, Jose Payan, who opened a business in the Mercado Central. I'm happy to say that today he started a business with he and his wife and his two sons, started a small business in Mercado Central. He currently has a business with sales of over $200 million,
Foods?
He produces tortillas on a wholesale level. He bought last year $1 million production building and $600,000 worth of equipment. He now has 45 employees. He still maintains his facility in Mercado Central, but now he is a wholesaler that provides wholesale tortillas to Cub, to over 100 restaurants and to other grocery stores and retail areas. A second business in the Mercado Central opened a third restaurant this year at 4th and Lake, which 10 years ago was a very difficult corner in Lake Street. He also bought $1 million building. He is opening this month a third restaurant in Burnsville. These are two examples of what small incubation markets like Mercado Central can result in. The Latino immigrants on Lake Street have been one of the driving forces in revitalizing Lake Street. I had an earlier experience on Nicollet Avenue in the Whittier neighborhood, where Asian immigrants were the driving force that revitalized a commercial strip that was headed downward until Asian immigrants came and turned it into a thriving commercial strip again. The goal of the global market follows a smaller example at Mercado Central, in which international entrepreneurs from many different cultures and ethnic backgrounds are featured as a link between a revitalized Sears building, in which corporate clients like Alina and Sherman Associates are involved, a link between that corporate world and the Lake Street of immigrant entrepreneurs. We think this is a very symbolic development because it links those two groups, but it also is very important to the individual businesses that are in the market. I think we're making a proposal to all of you to help support this incubator role and to look forward to a future in which immigrant business people can be tapped for a significant resource that they can provide as entrepreneurs in this state. Thank you.
Okay. I'd have to refer to the 116M.18 to figure out how these some of the loans are working and how some grants and other things. I suppose there's a combination of many things involved here. And it's administered by?
Be administered by?
Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And the Neighborhood Development Center would? What have you got there, a board of directors?
I'm the executive director.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
How many jobs at the end of the day, if you get that building filled up, will there be approximately out
right
there?
Right now we have about 250, and we're expecting maybe another 50. We had projected initially about 300, so we're well on our way to be there. We're at 90% occupied right now.
That's pretty good, yeah. Senator Scheid, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I did. Wanted to ask Senator Dibble if, is this going to be a revolving fund? I know I carried some legislation expanding a minority loan program that expanded it from a handful of cities to, like, we added another handful of cities that had a certain percentage of minority population, and that's a revolving loan fund. I wondered if that was the intention here. So, because I see that some of this is loans. I assume you'd try to make as much of it loan as you – well, I shouldn't assume that at all, but that seemed like that would be a good idea. I just wondered if this was something you intended to be a revolving loan fund.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, yes, that is correct. About $500,000 of this would be earmarked as a working capital loan fund. I believe some of that some would be added to that as well from some matches from some other source. An individual is giving $250,000. Another entity is giving $50,000 to put into this pool for working capital for these minority micro enterprises. And of course, it would be a revolving loan. There would be a one-year deferral repayment of the loans so that they could, you know, get into start to get into the black and then start repaying those loans after a year.
Thank you.
sounds like a $32 a square foot. That's pretty stiff for, you'd think, but that makes it doubly hard for the folks to make it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it costs about $17 million to build out the market. $6.6 million of that was debt, and about $3.6 million remains to be paid off in debt. And so for if they're able to pay off the remainder of that
debt,
that would remove a great deal of the annual expense to the market and allow them to lower their rents. Additionally, some of the resources we use to prepay some of the fees that go towards the administration of the tax credits that
I had to read a little further.
US
it's at the bottom of the page where that'll help reduce rents, expand working capital. Yeah, it's got it laid out pretty nicely. All right, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I happened to be at the global market last Friday night, and it was there were people there even though there was mostly snow on the ground and it was hard to travel. Very exciting place, great music, great offerings. Even though most of the shops were closed, there's still some food places open, and we had some great ethnic food. This is certainly a worthwhile place to support. It can be a real economic draw for a part of the city that badly needs it. A very exciting part of town to visit. I encourage everyone to do that in this location in particular. It's certainly worthy of support.
We'll take the committee out there and have one of these all-natural beef steaks from West Concord, Minnesota.
Mr. Chair,
on Wednesday, Mr. Talk for lunch.
The market
Wednesday
is,
for lunch.
It would be a worthwhile.
I got a dinner spot, too, that later in the day. All right.
It's a little far afield from my district. It's the other side of the freeway from my part of Lake Street. It's in Senator Berglund's district. But many, many of my constituents go to the global market quite a bit. I go there quite a bit. And if you're just to drive up and down Lake Street, if you haven't lately, it is incredible what's happened on Lake Street. It is,
well, you mentioned in
it is
too,
amazing.
Senator
this
Dibble
and
about
all the other old, rundown, underutilized, unused commercial buildings are now being filled with immigrant entrepreneurs. It's really amazing.
And the crime rate is down 25% out in the
which is incredible. Too. Anyone who's been on Lake Street in the recent past knows how uncomfortable it can be to be there, and it's not like that anymore, or as much.
Well, this is an exciting
might be a lot of
project. So, Senator Latz, having been the most recent visitor out here to the global market, makes the motion to be referred to the full or the finance committee. Discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, members.
No, I'm taking this.
David, are you ready? And this is the last bill we're hearing this afternoon. Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 1173.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1173 is an authorization to the IRRRB, which allows the board to purchase forest lands in the Taconite Assistant Area, and the funds would specifically be authorized for the purchase. We would get the funding out of the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Trust Fund. There's a blank there because we don't exactly know how much just yet we would need. What it would do is the board would be able to purchase forest lands that are currently being offered for sale by Potlatch. There's about 110,000 acres, and the reason we would like to have this authority at the board is because the fact that we want to try and prevent fragmentation of the forest lands and the uses of the forest lands, and we also want to be able to have access to the forest lands both for our logging industry and for our tourist industry, and if these acres are all parceled out one here, one there. We're kind of worried that by being in private ownership, we might end up harming the economy of the area, both from the standpoint of the forest industry, the gravel industry, and as well as the tourist industry. And so essentially what this does is just is an authorization for the board to be able to enter into an agreement to purchase some of this forest land.
What does it mean, allowing transfer of money from what?
The money would come from the Douglas J. Johnson Fund, Mr. Chairman, and so that would allow the board to use the Douglas J. Johnson account that's at the agency to purchase this land. Potlatch is specifically the company that is selling the land. Previously, there was about 305,000 acres that were sold, and Cabela's actually bought it, and now they're marketing the 305,000 acres to private landowners. And what it's essentially doing is it's dividing up the forest lands in such a way that it's fragmenting the forest land. So access to these lands, whether they be trails or whether they be logging operations or whether they be gravel operations, is being split up and split out so that we're actually kind of afraid that we might have a problem in the near future using these lands the way that we've been using in the past and benefiting the state of Minnesota. So this is just an authorization for the IRRB to be able to do this. Well, currently under law, we can't do it right now. Currently,
well, you got to move it around.
That's all. So if everybody's sufficiently confused, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1173 be recommended to pass. And I don't know if it should go to the Finance Committee or not.
I say taxes, I guess.
Is it taxes?
Yeah.
I think Senator Bach wants it in taxes. I think you're right. Yeah.
All right. Everybody confused enough?
Sure.
We're going to pass it out of here for you, though.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All those in favor of the Thomasoni motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
I think we hear a number of bills. Well, like all the other committees, we got to get our money bills out of here this week. And we've got a full agenda of Wednesday. And if at all possible, because we're getting out of session like at noon or 1:45, try to eat up and get here at 12:30 if you can. And then we might not have to come back Wednesday night. So put a little ring around your finger or something, or a string around your phone. Oh, yeah, whatever it is. And be here Wednesday as soon as you can, about 12:30. Okay, meeting's adjourned. We don't want to.